Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This is the first of many series devoted to specific artists that have helped shape Broadway as we know it today, both for better and for worse. It is called A Little Sondheim Music, and it is dedicated to the musicals of one Mr. Stephen Sondheim. I am your host, Matt Koplik, the least famous and most opinionated of all the Broadway podcast hosts. And with me today is a friend of the pod, alum of the pod. I can't shake this bitch away. Each time I'm like... Each time I'm like, we need space. She's like, no, I want to come on again and talk about things. I need the world to know that I have opinions. And I'm like, calm down. But you know what? We want to get good karma on our side. So we said yes, and we allowed her to come back on. Please welcome one Miss Allie Gordon.
Wow, thank you so much. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Am I the most frequent guest?
Yes, officially.
Yes, yes. That feels so good. Can I be honest? That feels so good.
As well as should. You surpassed Sutton Lee Seymour, who has been on 3 times. And now you are, I think this is number 4 for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I really respect that. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And also, like, Sutton hasn't been on in over a year. So you definitely have done the most in the last calendar year as well.
I feel amazing. Can I just say,
yes,
before this starts, we would be so good as Seymour and Audrey, except I'm Seymour and you're Audrey. Do you feel me?
100%.
I think we'd be great, but like, I don't think I'd be a good Audrey to your Seymour. Like, I think it works one way only.
That's absolutely fair. I never thought of it that way. I'll do it.
We should do it.
I think we should absolutely do that.
I think we should get it done.
Once I get my second shot, which by the time this episode comes out, I will have been fully vaxxed and like ready to go.
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. I will have spit all over you by the time this comes out. Also, by the time this episode comes out, we will have known the winner of this season of Drag Race for like over a month.
So. Wow. That's hard to conceive because I feel like I was a child, a mere child when season 13 started.
Yes. My baby came to term during this season of Drag Race. Allie, enough of this bullshit. What are we talking about today?
We are talking about everybody's favorite Sondheim show, probably the most recognized in the canon. Mm-hmm. When people talk about his scores and people say, what's the best score? This one frequently comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with book and iconic performances that people know and will remember forever. Of course, we're talking about The Frogs.
The Frogs. Yeah,
I have some actual behind the scenes of this.
Say what?
Well, I was like, do you mind if I offer some actual like behind the scenes of how we came here to this?
Oh, yes. Day? Well, so I reached out to you about this series from the get-go. And I was like, you're coming back on. you know, give me a list of the ones that you'd be willing to talk about. And I knew like Sweeney would be on there, and I don't know what else, like Forum. I mean, guess
like
you
anything. You and I were like, you and I were like 11-year-old Sondheim fanatics.
Yes, but then you dropped a bombshell on me, and you said, you said, what did you say?
I said, I'm probably the only person who'd be willing to talk about the Frogs.
Because
I am, because I am. I used to say I was the only person in all of New York City who saw the Frogs. Obviously, that isn't true. I think I might be the only 13-year-old in all of New York City to have seen the Frogs.
That's also very possible.
That's very possible.
It's very possible. You might have been the youngest person to see that show. But it did technically play for 4 months from the summer to the autumn of 2004. So like there, and it was and it's Lincoln Center. So it was, you know, subscriber base. So like definitely people saw it, and maybe someone took their grandchild who was like, the fuck is this? I don't know. You might be. You just might be. But yes, you are.
I might be.
It doesn't sound all that special to be like, oh, here's a guest who's seen the show we're talking about. But in this case, it
is. Yeah, I mean, I also, and I'm sure we will talk about this too, still am, but I was like a fanatic for the work of Nathan Lane as a child. Like, he was my favorite actor, without a doubt. I watched every movie that Nathan Lane was in. I went and I saw The Producers alone at the age of 11 because it was such a hot ticket that my parents couldn't get. They were like, well, we don't like musicals, so we're not willing to spend like $500 on a stupid ticket to see a show we're not even going to like. So I remember my birthday present, I think for my 11th birthday, was a ticket to see The Producers alone.
That's the best kind of birthday present you could ask for.
Can you imagine being an adult going to see The Producers and being sat next to a lone 11-year-old? Like, can you imagine how that would feel?
Yeah, well, so no, Allie, there's a difference between an 11-year-old and an 11-year-old you.
That is so true. I'm sure I was scary.
No, I'm sure you were perfectly polite, and then the show started and you were a nightmare because you probably laughed with the energy of 1,000 old men.
I think that's 100% correct. I remember hurting from laughing, which is also like true. The show was fantastic. So it's like, I'm the only person in the world who ever thought it's funny. But like, I was having the time of my life. And then I remember my dad picked me up in a cab and we went home because I wasn't allowed to go home by myself because I was 11.
You were allowed to see The Producers by yourself, but you weren't allowed to go home by yourself.
Yeah, he was like, meet me over at this corner. And I did. And we got in a cab and we went home. So
did you see the Frogs by yourself?
100% I saw the Frogs by myself.
Wow. Okay. Do you remember where you sat? I have this weird brain where I can remember exactly where I sat for every show I've ever seen.
I don't have that same sense memory, but I do for the Frogs because I was in the front row of the balcony of Vivian Beaumont.
Otherwise known as the Loge.
The Loge.
You uncultured fuck. It's called the Loge.
I haven't been there in such a long time. That's like the best seat in the house is like,
oh yeah. Well, the Beaumont, I don't think there's necessarily a bad seat, but I would say if I had to choose, I would like to be in the front center of the Loge.
I was like left or right of center. I don't think I was like right in the center, but it was the first row. It was great. Yeah. I had a great time. And so like, obviously for me, I was very excited because I got to see Nathan Lane, who I was like obsessed with. Mm-hmm. And because nobody saw the Frogs, I met him after, which for me was monumental.
You went to the stage door and you met him afterwards.
And do you know how many people were at the stage door?
Just you.
Completely correct.
Yeah.
He walked out with a person who was either like a bodyguard or a driver and like saw one random child standing. You know how like the stage door was like technically like the parking lot?
Yeah, it's right by the parking lot.
I mean, this didn't even have like, I have not stage doored anything there ever since. So I assume for big things, they have like a sectioned off thing or like using rope to cordon off a hallway. Like there was nothing. I literally was just like a girl standing in front of a car.
Yeah. Well, the Beaumont, because the Vivian Beaumont's part of Lincoln Center Theater, nothing that Lincoln Center Theater has ever really produced has like warranted huge crowds of screaming fangirls. So I don't know if they've ever done like a barricade for the stage door, at least anytime that I've ever gone.
What about like when Patti LuPone did Anything Goes?
I don't think there was much stage door culture at the time.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm going to cough again. You have to edit this out.
Guess what, bitch? That's staying in.
It was a good cough. You can hear how clear my voice sounded after.
I remember I stage doored at the Beaumont. The first time I ever stage door to the Beaumont was the summer of 05. And I had just come back from Stage Door Manor Performing Arts Camp. And
oh, tell me about it.
You know, you tell me about it, Stud. But they've never done the frogs there, I can tell you that.
I thought they did in the swimming pool.
Stage door?
Yeah,
I thought that was a joke.
No, okay, maybe I'm insane, but, and maybe I took a joke as serious. I thought that the last show they ever did with that stupid indoor swimming pool, or like they made something where they did the frogs with the indoor swimming pool, and then it got covered up, and then they didn't use it for years, and then it became, what was it called?
The Oasis Theater.
Was it called the Oasis?
Yeah, the pool was used literally up until they decided to turn it into a theater. So it was like, that was a pool in use. Stage Door Manor had two pools, an outdoor pool and an indoor pool. And no, I don't think that the frogs was actually ever done in that pool. I think that was a joke.
God damn it.
We'll understand the joke of that as we get into the history of Le Frogs.
I think I believed it.
I believe it today. Maybe they did. It definitely didn't happen while I was there. And I was there during the time where it was still a pool and then became a theater. So in those years, it was never done. But maybe I was there.
I did the first musical in the Oasis. I just forgot the name of the fucking show.
First of all, no, you didn't.
Oh, no, you did. I'm so sorry.
I did the first musical in the Oasis.
I'm so sorry to have taken that from you live.
I do not care for your erasure. I do not.
See, I seem to remember The Mystery of Edwin Drood being the first musical ever performed at the Oasis.
See,
first musical ever performed by me at the Oasis.
That is 100% true. See, I have this in wonderful memory of doing Bat Boy at the age of 18, opening up the Oasis Theater and metaphorically pissing all over the stage and walking off and going, top that, bitches. And then just, you know, no one ever did.
Really? I have a strong sense memory of me just mopping the stage. Just wiping your piss up.
And see, I have a memory of you just slipping and eating it. Just, and I was in the audience that day, and rather than help you up, I took your head and smothered it in there. I was like, how do you like that? If this seems graphic and gross, wait till we get to the frogs, which is not graphic and gross, but artistically makes you clean up a bit. So let's just get into this. My stage door story was just that I was at... I was out with friends that day. It was the summer of 2005. And I was like, I was just going on about lighting the piazza. And everybody's like, well, the matinee's about to let out soon. Like, do you want to stop by and like take some photos with the cast? I was like, oh no, I'm sure like there are going to be so many people there. Not a single person. It was just me. And like took photos with Kelly O'Hara, Victoria Clark, Sarah Urite Barry. And they were just like, oh, did you like the show? And I'm like, I actually saw it 3 months ago, but I was too nervous to come stage door it. So here I am now getting my zhuzh.
It's kind of, it's funny that we both have that experience in like separate weird nerdy timelines.
Yeah. Well,
but
this
like, I remember I was like, all the like musicians were leaving and they were like, do you need something? Cause I was like standing there for such a long time. And I was like, oh, I was kind of like hoping to meet the cast. And I remember like random people being like, oh yeah, they're coming. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like I remember like some guy coming out with like a bassoon being like, oh, Nathan Lane. Yeah, he's coming. And I was like, okay. And I was like nervously standing there with a pen and my thing. But like none of them were even like, I don't even know if he'll have time, sweetheart. They were just like, yeah, he's coming. Yeah. And then we talked for like a while.
Yeah, I think that was sort of a case where because that show was sort of, everyone thought that show was going to be a big thing and then it was sort of a big nothing. And so by that point, I'm sure they were like, oh yeah, no one stages it anymore. So they were like, when they finish the show and walk out the stage door, they just expect to like go home. And then every now and then there's a random person who's like, hi, love to get your autograph. And they're like, oh, that's right. We did a show that a person enjoyed today.
Yeah, that a child enjoyed today.
Yes, specifically you, a child. So let's get into it because we've stalled long enough. We need to talk about the nitty gritty of what is Le Frogs. So Le Frogs, you know what? What is it about? What's the plot of this damn show?
Okay. The plot of the show is that Dionysus, who is a half god, but is the god of wine and revelry, and like arts and culture, I suppose.
Yeah, wine and drama.
I don't know. They say a million different things. Every scene, they're like, I'm the of wine and sex. You're like, okay, we got
any dinner table fight during a Real Housewives episode that you enjoy, you can thank Dionysus for that because there's wine and drama.
I feel that so profoundly. I feel like that is the table of offering. is the table that Teresa flipped in season one of Real Housewives.
With prostitution whores.
Yes. That is like the sacrificial offering table that we leave for Dionysus.
Every damn day.
He, so Dionysus. He has noticed that the world is in a state of disarray. This is supposed to take place kind of in modern times, but also kind of in Greek times. They never really super decide on that one.
Yeah, the joke is the time is now, the place is ancient Greece.
Exactly, which is funny. I actually think that's a funny line.
Sure.
And so, you know, in 2004, we're talking about when they're talking about like our incompetent leaders, we're talking about like George Bush and we're talking about the Iraq war. And then in Greece, they're talking about like, you know, random, sort of ahistorical, just Greece.
So it is, first of all, before we go any further down this rabbit hole, it is inspired by a play.
It's an Aristophanes play called The Frogs, which does take place and actually have to do with real Greek leaders and things like that. But none of those things are...
Because it was written towards the end of the Peloponnesian War, which went on for what, like 20-something years, I think?
That sounds right.
Yeah, very long time. And who is it? Pericles, I think? Maybe? No. I'm going to find out exactly who it was. Euripides, the great tragedy poet, you know, wrote many a play, had died the year before, which inspired Aristophanes to write The Frogs during the Peloponnesian War, which then was adapted by Burchevlov in the 40s and then again with Sondheim in the 70s, and then the version we have now with Nathan Lane. And we're back. So Dionysus, he sees the state of the world. They're
Thank
at
you.
War.
Actually, I didn't know all of the details there.
Peloponnesian War in ancient Greece, even though it's also still technically now.
Yes. So he keeps being like, we can't trust our leaders to inspire the people. Have you seen our leaders? And it's like, ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
It's always the same. But essentially, he wants to go to Hades to bring back a great writer to inspire the masses, because he thinks that that since we have done everything we can politically speaking and war speaking, we should start trying to inspire the people of the world, and one of our great artists should be able to do that. And then in the course of The Frogs, the person that Dionysus wants to bring back is George Bernard Shaw.
Yes. And then eventually, once he gets down there, ends up taking Shakespeare with him.
Yes.
Because once he's down there and meets Shaw and loves Shaw, Shakespeare sort of shows up, and then Shaw and Shakespeare like go into a clash of wit and talent and literature of who's the better poet. And Dionysus is like, well, you know, Shaw won't come up with me to the living world until he gets this out of his system. He's like, so you know what? Yeah, you guys hash it out. Do your thing. And so they do like a contest of, you know, they each can only, they're not allowed to come up with anything new. They have to quote their previous works at each other based on a specific theme.
Right. It's like a rap battle.
Essentially, yes. It's a rap battle.
Like, all right, your theme is, or whatever, is this. And then it's love, it's death, it's...
Yeah, the last one they do is
change,
on death.
Change, whatever it is.
Yeah. But it's a rap battle if, like, you went into your archives. Like, they're not coming up with it on the spot. They are going into their treasure trove of plays to quote from. So, like, Shaw does St. Joan at one point. I forget the other one that he does, but what ends up happening is Shakespeare quotes Cymbeline for death, and it ends up moving Dionysus so much that he changes his mind and decides to bring Shakespeare up with him instead of Shaw.
Yes.
Changes the masses. And in all of this is Dionysus's slave, Xanthias, Xanthesis. Xanthesis.
No, it's Xanthias.
Xanthias.
I think you're thinking of Kimmy Schmidt.
I think I am.
Oh. I think you're thinking of Xanthippe.
Xanthippe, yes, that's the name of the girl in Kimmy Schmidt. Xanthippe. And there's like a whole bunch of other stuff that is added, I'm pretty sure, to this version. Like Dionysus had a wife that's died, and he sees her again in Hades. And
I looked up the list of the original songs that were written in the 70s for Yale. It's not a huge list. It's like Invocation and Instructions for the Audience. The finale is the same. That like Evoe, the like hymn to Dionysus,
singer,
and then like the song The Frogs. But like almost anything else that you could like really hum from this score is new.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of the score for this version is new. Plus, on top of that, I think that it's just like a lot of bits were added because the original version was 90 minutes and then got stretched out to 2.5 hours for Broadway. So we talked about the plot for a bit. Let me go into the sort of the history of how we got here, why we have what we have here, and then we'll talk more about the show itself. So as we mentioned, Aristophanes wrote this play, The Frogs, back in his good old days of ancient Greece. And Bert Shevlov, who was one of the book writers for A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, when he was a supervisor for the Yale Dramatic Association in the late 30s and early 40s, directed and devised an adaptation of The Frogs. And the whole like to do was it was in the Yale swimming pool, because there's the whole way that Dionysus gets to Hades, which is, you know, the underworld and the, you know, land of the dead, is because he doesn't want to kill himself in order to get there. So he finds out the only way he can do that is that he has to travel by boat across the lake, which is, you know, how a lot of people travel through Hades. And so for that scene, anytime that he's in the boat, when they did this in the 40s, they did it in the Yale swimming pool, which is one of those like, oh, that's really clever. But there's a pool for the rest of the show that's totally unused. And then in the 70s, what ended up happening was Sondheim was helping out with some charity event that the person who was like organizing the whole thing was like, oh, I decided to like string a couple of songs together with a loose plot, and that's going to be like the performance for this benefit. And Sondheim's like, you don't know what you're doing. This is going to be terrible, but I need, it's like, I would like this benefit to go well. So he called up Bert Shevlov. He's like, hey, can you come in unpaid for like 2 weeks and make this thing make sense and be entertaining? And Shevlov's like, sure, no problem. And Sondheim's like, I knew when I did that, I was owing him a favor at some point. And then like a year later, 1973, so Sondheim's done Company and Follies and Night Music at this point, Shevlov's like, hey, so Yale would like me to do The Frogs again for Yale Repertory Theater, which I don't know if they still do this, but at the time it basically was just like a platform for their drama students to do shows pretty much unpaid and then charge money for it. I don't know if they still do that, but that was what it was at the time. They're like, oh yes, come see all the classics in our repertory theater, and we are making hand over fist because we are not paying anybody because they're all technically students.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I mean, I might be over exaggerating it a bit, but that was definitely a thing, and it was, and happens with this. But so Shevlov's like, they would like me to do The Frogs again, and I would like you to write some songs for it, and we're going to do it in the pool again. And the man who was the head of Yale drama rep was Robert Brustein, who was a critic and a failed playwright in his own way, and apparently had been very public about not liking Sondheim's work. He wrote reviews for the New Republic, and Sondheim's like, I don't think you want me. Brustein doesn't like my work. And Shevlov's like, no, I spoke with Brustein and he likes your, and he's willing to let you do it. And Sondheim's like, well, that sounds a little two-faced, but okay. And he's sort of writing this at the same time that Hal Prince is calling in his favor and being like, hey, can you write new lyrics for this revival of Candide that I'm doing in Chelsea? Which I think is actually very important because it influences some of the lyric writing that he does for The Frogs, which is like very playful, very like light and sort of farcical, especially with the opening song. I'm like, it makes sense that he wrote this while writing lyrics for Candide. And so Sondheim basically said, like, I should have known that there was trouble afoot, because when I met with Brustein, he was very condescending and again, very two-faced. But I sort of plowed ahead because I owed Shevlov the favor. And I thought, hey, this will be fun. Like, low stakes. We're writing a 90-minute musical for a college, for Yale. And no one's...
We're writing a 90-minute musical for Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep and Sigourney Weaver.
So true.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, it's so low stakes. It's just students. He's like, it'll be a learning experience for everybody. And no one of importance is going to come see it. It'll just be whatever. But come 1974, when this is coming to be and Candide is now opened in New York and is a big hit, they're in rehearsals and everything's going smoothly, and then they get to what's supposed to be their tech rehearsals, and Robert Brustein has not fireproofed any of the sets that are going to be in the gymnasium with the swimming pool, and the fire department in New Haven gets wind of this, and they say, okay, so you have to shut everything down and fireproof all of your sets, otherwise we're shutting the whole thing down. Yep. So that cuts into their tech rehearsals, And Sondheim and Shevlov were like, hey, can we push back the opening 4 days so we can, like, you know, have a dress rehearsal? We're basically going to be teching up to the last minute. And Robert Brustein's like, no, we can't, because we sold all the tickets. And also because I might have invited critics from New York to come to opening night. Oopsie. Sorry about it.
What?
Yep.
This is so weird. I don't know any of these stories.
Oh, it's all in Finishing the Hat, Henny.
Okay. I remember Finishing the Hat, but I read it like voraciously as a, what, 17-year-old or whatever, well, when it came out, and like never again.
It's only the frog section of Finishing the Hat is worth it just for like the story leading up to it. He doesn't really have any notes on the lyrics for it. And he says as much towards the end. He's like, sorry that I don't have many notes on these lyrics.
I was teching up until opening.
But he's also like, this show was sort of a big nothing for me. Like, it was meant to be fun to do, and it really wasn't fun to do until we had finally opened and like were able to sort of run it and fix whatever we needed to fix. And then he's like, then doing the revisal wasn't really all that fun, but we'll get to that in a second. But so basically what happened was, like, Sondheim and Shevlov realized that Robert Brustein was trying to turn Yale drama into like a scouting area for Broadway stuff. Like, he wanted this thing to go to Broadway. He wanted Yale to be like the new place that people went to see, like, oh, what's Yale gonna do, in the way that Diane Paulus kind of turned ART
into
an out-of-town tryout spot. That's what Brustein was trying to do with Yale. And Sondheim has the harshest of words to say to about him in Finishing the Hat with this, but he also has like very harsh words about academia in general. He's like, I think it's very important that artists go to school for these things. I just wish that the teachers weren't like failed artists themselves.
Woo!
He said what he said. He said what he said.
And he meant what he said, because a Sondheim is certain 100%.
Mm-hmm.
You have to cut that out.
I'm keeping it.
You have to cut it out.
Honestly, I actually said something similar to that in the Follies episode.
Oh no.
I know. So it just goes to show you and I are both the exact same.
Yeah, and we both immediately regretted it. And we're like, cut that out. It's too late now.
Maybe we should do like a True West style little shop where we flip-flop with Audrey and Seymour every other night.
I think that's really fun.
Yeah. That's the only way you'll be Audrey and I'll be Audrey, is that like the audience isn't forced to see it 8 times a week.
That's correct, because otherwise I will never play that role.
No.
I think I have some interesting things to say.
About Audrey?
I think I have some interesting things to say.
Yeah, I think you can do some fun things with that role.
I have some interesting things to say about that role.
So basically that's the end of the frogs for a very long time. It gets done like randomly here and there regionally. And only the opening number is ever really used in anything of note in terms of like Sondheim reviews or any kind of like concerts that people do of Sondheim works.
Right. The opening number, and please tell me if I'm wrong, because I know you'll know. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it a draft of something that got scrapped for Forum?
Yes. The first half of the opening number was a first attempt at an opening number for Forum,
which got scrapped real quick. And then there was Love Is in the Air, which also got scrapped, and then Comedy Tonight.
Yes.
Okay.
Birch Abbott, who directed Forum, was like, I can't hum this song you wrote, Steve. And the original song was supposed to be about like how what you're going to see is like a body show. And so he wrote Love Is in the Air, and Abbott's like, I can hum it, I love it. And then they go out of town and it bombs. And Robbins comes in and he's like, your opening number is all wrong. You're telling people this is going to be like a Kaufman and Hart play. It's not.
Yes.
Or like a Noel Coward show. And you need a song that's going to tell you that this is going to be a romp. And Sondheim's like, I wrote it. And Abbott said he couldn't hum it. And Robbins goes, okay, dick, write one.
Just write another one.
Like, write one he can hum that does what you're supposed to do. Which I love. It's because Sondheim's like, I did that. And Robbins like, well, do it again.
Yeah. Well, do it better this time.
Yeah. Maybe step up to the plate, gay. I hope someone said that once to Sondheim in his career. Step up to the plate, you queer.
Yeah, I actually think they said that during the out of town tryouts for Passion.
Jokes on you, there was no out of town tryout for Passion.
That's why it's funny, okay?
Fuck you. It was during workshops, and everybody was like, Steve, listen, we see what you're trying to do, but maybe make it better, you faggot.
But didn't we just talk about how we both, how now older, are like, you know what? Passion is really great.
I don't think it's great, but I think there's a lot more to it than I originally thought.
Another story that I have about being a child out of place was I once met Donna Murphy when I was like, I'm going to say like 12. Mm-hmm. And I very seriously told her that I loved her as Fosca in Passion. And she laughed. And then she went, oh, you're being serious. And I was like, yeah, I really am.
She's not used to hearing that very often. I don't know if
especially not from like a child who purports as a like 40-year-old woman.
I don't know if I mentioned this on the Passion episode. It's been so long since I recorded it, but my grandmother, Nancy Ticton, my mom's mom, hated Passion so much when it came out that she, for years, had a dislike for anyone involved with it.
Wild.
Because, like, I remember her seeing Kiss Me, Kate, and being like, I mean, Brian Stokes Mitchell's wonderful, but, like, Maren Maisie, she's not really doing much. And I'm like, you just don't like her because you didn't like Passion. Like, she's That's great wild. In the show. And then, like, for years wouldn't say that she liked Donna Murphy. I think finally she said that she liked Donna in, like, Follies at Encores, which was, like, 13 years later.
That's wild.
So wild. It took her forever. She had such a grudge about it. But you know what she didn't see? Or maybe she did, because she worked at Lincoln Center at the time. The frogs.
Well, nobody did except for me.
Well, so what ends up happening is apparently like Nathan Lane gets a copy of the script in the late 70s. But also, yes, we mentioned earlier in the ensemble for the Frogs at Yale in 1974 are a young Meryl Streep, Sigourney Weaver, and Christopher Durang. They also include the Yale swimming team as the frogs that are in the lake. And it's, you know, many different departments came together to do this thing.
And including such famous swimmers as, can you imagine? If we were just like some names you might recognize.
Yes. Robert Herschelberger.
Yeah.
Joseph Levinson.
You're so good at first names and you're so bad at last names.
Yeah. Well, it's easier to think of first names than to make up last names.
That's true. When I was still doing improv really a lot, I had a list of like go-to first names and last names. So I never got like put on the spot and said like Dick Face. Dick. And now they're all gone.
Richard Face.
That's so funny. That's a funny joke.
Yeah.
Now that's good.
I'm fucking funny. I'm smart. I am funny. I'm a writer sometimes.
Anywho. I have some interesting things to say about the role.
I got interesting things to say. Oh my God. We've been recording for so long and we've mentioned the frog so little. So honestly, that's what this episode is.
Yeah, what is there to say about the frogs?
Yeah. So Nathan Lane gets a script of it and he becomes like weirdly enamored with the show for all of the 80s and early 90s. And then he does a concert of it at the Library of Congress with Brian Stokes Mitchell. And he basically comes to Sondheim and he's like, I would like to do a musical of this. If we can work on this with Susan Stroman and like get this thing up to snuff for like a Broadway stage, would you write some songs? And Sondheim basically is like, I guess. And Lincoln Center signs up for it. And basically, this is like 3 years after The Producers, and it's right after the Assassins revival comes out. Assassins comes out in April, and this starts previews in late June at Lincoln Center Theater. And I remember when it was announced for the 2004-2005 season, everyone was like, oh, this might be like the show of the season. Because you have, it's technically speaking a new Sondheim score. Yes, half of it was written in the 1970s, but he's written like seven new songs. Nathan Lane's doing the book based off of a book that people already enjoyed. Susan Stroman's directing and choreographing it. Lincoln Center's producing it. Like, this is going to be good. And it opened on July 22nd of 2004. And we'll get into the responses in a bit.
Ooh.
But yeah.
Here's the thing. I want to say, like, as much as I keep being like, it's nothing, I actually really don't think it's bad. Like, it's legitimately pretty funny in a lot of places. It is like tonally confused as its biggest critique. And also like it has like a really fun first act. And unfortunately, when it gets to the second act, it kind of, we're just like, we got to find Shaw. And like that becomes like the entirety of the second act. And that's a little sad.
Mm-hmm.
And like not much else happens. But it's funny.
It has its moments. Nathan Lane wrote a lot of good jokes.
Yeah.
I found audio of the Yale production on YouTube, which I think I sent you. It's not great audio because it's
listened to a little because I was sort of having trouble staying focused with such bad audio.
It's also very echoey, so it's hard sometimes to make up all the words. But what I discovered this morning while I was sort of preparing for recording today was an album that Nathan Lane and Brian Stokes Mitchell recorded in like 2000, 2001 of the Frogs, of like the score as it was written originally. And I liked listening to that so much more than I liked listening to the 2004 Broadway recording, because it's much more like, here's the opening song. Everything, first of all, is done in a style of ancient Greek theater, which is that there's a chorus that sings and they basically are representative of all the characters, you know, no character in the actual show itself sings once the show begins. I'm almost positive. There's a chorus that sings about the action in the original version of the frogs. So that's why I like the opening is technically called Prologus. And then they have Hymnus and all these other things, which are versions of songs that were done in ancient Greek drama. And then when it was done for Broadway, Nathan Lane's like, we're making this a much more traditional musical, so the characters need to be able to sing. And so Sondheim wrote all these character songs for the show. And those are the songs I like the least.
Yeah. The group numbers are really fun, except for, honestly, unfortunately, I really like don't like The Frogs, the title song.
What I like is I like how it begins, and then when it gets to Where the Frogs,
yeah,
stuff, I don't like that.
I don't like it either. Sorry, Sondheim.
Intellectuals, not your hippie-dippie homosexuals, just your easy-going, simple, warm-hearted, cold-blooded frogs of the pond.
And I honestly, like, don't know how many Sondheim songs I've ever, like, go out of my way to be like, I don't like that, but I really don't like The Frogs. And I, like, when I was watching the video recording of it recently, I was like, I'm going to watch the whole number and I'm not going to skip. But there were, like, multiple times where I was like, bitch, stop. Your little fingers inching towards the computer to skip ahead. I just don't like it. And also, like, the other thing about them expanding it into a two-hour show is, like, in the original Greek script of the Aristophanes thing, like, the frogs still are meant to represent one thing, which is like people who resent and withstand, like
people who are complacent. I believe
withstand is not the right word. It's people who reject change, essentially. And so, like, you'd think that it's going to be a bigger struggle, or it's going to be a bigger metaphor for, like, you know, these artists trying to get out there and bring other artists back to change the world, while there's like you get met with like a complacent crowd or like an audience who's not ready to hear what you want to, like, that's kind of what you think it's going to be. And it isn't. They like encounter the frogs at the end of act one, and at the beginning of act two, everything's okay. And like, that's kind of it for the frogs.
Yeah. It's odd. So as I said before, the original musical that Shevlov did with Sondheim was 90 minutes, and they turned it into a 2.5 hour two act. The first act is like 45 minutes. It is short.
Yeah, it's fun. It flies by. I like it.
There are two songs from like Snippity Snip Snip. but that said, sure. Yeah, it does go by a lot quicker. Act two, my God, does it drag.
It's but just also, too long. Not a lot happens. Like, they're like, we got to find the guy. We found the guy. The guy's talking. The other guy's talking. Let's have a more structured talking.
You just said, we need to find the guy. We found the guy. Honey, that is 40 minutes of act two. Because before they find the guy, there are like little hiccups along the way. But they're not even really hiccups. It's like, they're on the boat. They get off the boat. There's a mixed up identity situation that goes on for 10 minutes, which doesn't amount to anything. And then there's like an orgy that happens that they end up not partaking in, but almost partake in. And then that doesn't happen. And then they like meet Pluto, and he's like, oh yeah, let me tell you how amazing Hades is. And then it's still like another 15 minutes till we finally see Shaw.
Right. And then I'm saying, when they see Shaw, you're like, this guy, oh, other guy, they're fighting. And then somebody's like, wait, stop fighting. And start fighting in a more structured way. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh no. And then that goes on for a while.
Yeah.
That's fair, a shame.
The rap battle essentially comes from the play itself. But again, these things are much more entertaining when they're sort of streamlined and it's sort of a condensed piece. When it's stretched out. And again, as you mentioned earlier, this version, the most recent version, has such tonal issues because it's trying to be a big romp for the first half. And then once it gets to the second half, it decides to take itself much more seriously. It's still like, yeah, has a lot of high, you know, sorry, I should say low humor to it, but it ends in such like, I don't want to say somber, but very like pensive state.
Yes, it's very serious. And it also ends with like a direct address to the audience. Like, it kind of breaks the fourth wall and like, they bring Shakespeare back and Dionysus is like, go on, Shakespeare, inspire them. And he like looks at you and is like, what's up? Okay, let me tell you what I'm about to say.
Yeah.
And that's also weird because like, it doesn't again feel like the same thing of like lovers divided, get I mean, different show. But like that's sort of what the opening sets up of sort of just being like, oh, bless our silly little show. We're silly little actors. Don't cough, don't do stuff. And then they're like, and also I'm going to look you directly in the eyes and like appeal to you to like change the world. And it's like, oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were still doing like, don't fart.
Yeah. Well, so that's what's so weird is the opening number. I love the opening number.
It's, me too.
It's my favorite song in the show. And there's a reason why it's done in reviews all the time, because it's such a fun way to start something. And it's also like, it is Sondheim at his most like, frat boy-y, but being Sondheim, he can't really go full-blown like South Park, but like this is his version of South Park.
Yeah, and it's like low, it's truly like low humor with brains, and yeah. It's very funny.
Do not intrude, please, when someone's nude, please, she's there for mood, please, and mustn't be embraced. If we are crude, please, don't come unglued, please, let's not be too straight-laced, the author's reputation wasn't based on taste. So please, don't fart. There's very little air and this is art. And if you feel offended...
And but then to use that exact same song later and change the tempo and the words to make it seem more, like, meaningful, it literally is, like, opening form with tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight, and then ending with tragedy tomorrow.
That's exactly right.
It's like, what the fuck are we doing here? Yeah. It's so odd.
Please, don't nod. Agreeing with me just 'cause I'm a god. Have some respect for Aristophanes. And please, don't nod. Don't just shrug. Content to be a conscientious slug. It's fine to feel content, it's safe and snug, but soon
it's hard to explain because, in a way, the show for the first half, like, kind of plays up the idea of people who think that art can save the world of like, oh, okay, look at these people. And then the second half, it's like, no, really.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, and I don't feel like they ever make a statement on like whether or not it is true that art can change the world. Like, there's no like...
They don't show it ever.
They don't show it. And also like with an... I mean, this is the problem of like Broadway just like in general. Sorry, this is going to sound very like... This is going to sound like an anti-capitalist rant. And I don't necessarily mean it this way entirely, but it's like...
A little bit though.
Shakespeare coming and looking at you in the eye, the person sitting there in the fourth row center of the Vivian Beaumont Theater. You probably don't need to hear or be convinced of the thing that like you're trying to be convinced of, which is that like art is important and we should be like questioning our leaders. It's like these are probably the richest, most liberal people potentially in the country. Do you know what I'm saying? And if not the entire audience, the preponderance of the audience.
Yeah.
Or the people who are the Lincoln Center subscribers. Like nobody needs to be told, like, if only Shakespeare was back, he'd have something to say. Like they're the people sharing memes on Facebook that are like, the orange Cheeto did it again. It's like they're not the people who need to hear it anyway. So it's like
you're not convincing anyone, they are already on your side.
They're so on your side. And so like the show doesn't even take a stance on whether or not art can change the world. It just kind of implies that it can because you're listening to it and you're a liberal. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I guess I was moved. Thank you. Well, and so it's like, it's not persuasive.
The timing of the show is very important because so as I said, the original Aristophanes Frogs came out during the Peloponnesian War, and it was about how like everyone become complacent because the war had gone on for so long and everyone basically was like, yeah, I guess like this is life now. And Euripides had just died, and so that's what made him write the play, because in the musical version it's Shaw and Shakespeare that have the rap battle, and Dionysus wants to bring Shaw back. In the play, in the original play, he goes down to get Euripides because he's like, we just lost one of our greatest artists, like bring him back. And then only for him to get down there. And I believe it's Aeschylus.
I don't remember.
Aeschylus, I believe, who he ends up bringing back up with him. And then there's a joke about how like, oh, have Sophocles take his place, because at the time that the play, The Frogs, opened, Sophocles had like just died, and they couldn't really make enough changes to make one of the characters Sophocles instead. So they're like, oh, we'll sprinkle in some jokes about Sophocles being dead. So
that's funny.
Yeah. So like Euripides had been dead for about a year at that point. And like, oh, okay. So like he's the big character. And they're like, are they not going to mention how Sophocles died literally a month ago? And then it's like, oh, so while I'm leaving Hades, have Sophocles take my place at the banquet table. And everyone's like, ha 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 ha, he's been dead for a month.
That's good.
Yeah.
Isn't it nice to know that people have always been funny?
Yeah.
I know, like, I really mean that seriously. Like, I'm like, isn't it nice that, like, to know that no matter how different, like, society is, there's always been somebody who's like, how about this zinger? Everyone was like, oh yeah, dude.
Like, it's like, well, it's the earliest example I can think of meta humor, where it's 12,000 people who all get the joke, because it's like, on its own, it's not a funny joke. It's a name drop joke that 12,000 people understand. It's the equivalent of Legally Blonde making a JetBlue joke. And we're like, completely, we get it. We've all done JetBlue. Like,
we love it. JetBlue. We flew here on JetBlue.
Yeah, we do too, honey.
I think that's very funny.
Yeah.
Wait, what was I going to say? I don't remember.
No, so going back to my thing, because I was in the middle of a statement and then you interrupted me with your...
with my own statement.
With your own so many thoughts. So what happened was Nathan Lane, we were sort of at the height of the Iraq war with Bush when Nathan Lane wanted to adapt the frogs even more so.
Right. And I do think that the analogy stands. Like, if that really was Nathan Lane's, like, primary reason for wanting to adapt it, was to be like, this is all still true, we are complacent, wars can go on forever and it just becomes background noise. Like, I don't think he's wrong.
No, it's absolutely justified, and I think that there's something there. But again, because there are moments when he, like, gets very earnest and very serious, and then they make a weed joke, and I'm like, it's not so much that you have to pick a lane, you can blend these two things together, but it doesn't blend. It is very much contrasting flavors. It is literally having a piece of cake and then following it up with steak, and you're like, what?
That sounds good.
You would have a full-blown slice of cake from the milk bar and followed up not even like an hour later, like 2 minutes later, with a filet mignon.
No, I would not.
Exactly. Is that
it is tonal dissonance. And like, the moments that are really funny are really funny, mm-hmm. but it's just they are like immediately followed up with something that's not funny.
Yeah,
because it's like, it's not like that, like, shows that are funny can't be serious, or shows that are serious can't be funny. Like, that's not the point. It's just that, like, it's the pendulum swings too far too fast.
Yes.
And you're not totally like sure which one you're supposed to feel. And ditto to, like, I just don't think this show takes a strong enough stance on what its opinion is about art, about idealism, about artists, about death. Like, it doesn't take, like, a super strong stance on any of them. They're just sort of, like, incremental in the plot. They're just, like, little, like, bits and pieces.
You know what I just had this thought of? This show, as it is currently written with the Nathan Lane text, reminds me of any Instagram post you see from someone where the caption is like this long story of, like, I've been really struggling with depression and we need to normalize mental health and getting therapy and having the right prescriptions, and we shouldn't be afraid of science and all these things. And the picture is them, like, half naked in the woods, like, with their butthole showing. And you're like, yes. I'm sorry, what am I supposed to be getting from this?
Because I am fully looking at your butthole.
Yes. Like, you wrote me this whole thing. And on top of that, it's to people who follow them who are most likely in their lives. And I'm like, are you changing any minds with this? I don't think anyone who's seeing this necessarily disagrees with you. On the off chance that, like, you also then put a hashtag that maybe would go to a MAGA person, and they'd be like, well, no, fuck mental health. You're either crazy or you're not.
Right. And it's, and like, then, I do wonder if the original text has, like, a stronger opinion about, like, what happens when you bring back a great artist. Like, do they make change, or does it stay complacent? Well, because, like, this show doesn't.
Yeah. So I have not read the original text. I've only read up on it. I will find
it. I read it in college, like, forever ago, because I knew the musical and I had to write a paper comparing some stuff. And I was like, this will be easy because I've seen the musical. But even then, it is still in one ear and out the other.
Speaking of college and musicals, how much do you like Fiorello, Allie?
Oh my God, I hate Fiorello so much.
I know you do.
And you know what? I feel so justified now, because, like, every time somebody was like, you should sing I Love a Cop, and I was like, I don't think so. Now it's like, hey, fuck you. Now no one will ever sing that song.
No one ever needs to sing that song. First of
all, no one ever will. And I've been right since the beginning.
You have
I was there in 1959 or whatever, being like, guys, don't do it.
Don't you do it. I love how people drag Carousel for being like, it glorifies wife beating. I'm like, well, it's a tragedy and it doesn't. And then you have Fiorello where it's literally a punchline about like a romantic song. And I'm like, I'm sorry, why haven't we canceled this Pulitzer Prize winner?
I don't know. It's a show that has not aged well, but people keep trying to like convince me it's aged just fine. And it's like not really. Marry the Very Next Man is also like a song that like won't, that like doesn't stand on its own 2 feet. And also like all the stuff that's like sort of glorifying like City Hall and politics. And it's like, none of this is good. Politics? None of this is good.
It's crazy to me that that's like the Pulitzer Prize winner of the Bach and Harnack catalog. Where
I know. And like, I think Fiddler is Pulitzer Prize worthy.
I think, well, Fiddler I don't think counts because it has to be about American stories. Although, no, that's not true because Diary of Anne Frank won.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what the, what it has to be about, what like the actual credentials have to be.
It has to be about Mac and Mabel.
It has to be about things other than the frogs. But so, okay. First of all, what's your favorite song on the show? Is it the opening?
I mean, the opening is a pretty strong fucking contender.
Yeah, I love it very much. It does begin with the whole, like, glory. It plays up your expectations because you hear it's a musical of a Greek, ancient Greek comedy. And so it begins with this whole, like, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? It sounds very old school and very, like, pretentious.
The fanfare?
The fanfare, yes, very pretentious. Yes. And then it goes into, like, quirky musical theater. And they do the whole like some do's and don'ts. And I just think it's so funny. I think the rhymes are clever. I think the whole thing makes sense. And it is one of the rare Sondheim show songs where it works out of context as well as it works in context.
Totally.
Yeah.
One little tidbit that I wanted to share is, have you ever listened to Comedy Bang Bang?
No.
They used to do a bit. I don't think they do it anymore. Where, hold on, I think I wrote it down. Yes. Okay. They might still do it. The bit was called Would You Rather, and it truly was just a Would You Rather game.
Uh-huh.
But Scott Aukerman, every time he would start the game, would play the entirety of that fanfare. That's like probably 35 to 40 seconds long.
It's over a minute long.
Great. So the bit was that if you tried to interrupt him or stop the fanfare from going, he'd be like, shh, 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 you're being rude. You're being really rude. Like, this happened like so many times. He'd get like multiple guests on who'd like done it a million times. Mm-hmm. Because he'd known they'd done it before, he would like plan to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is linked in my mind with that Comedy Bang Bang bit that I think is really funny.
I guess that's part of the legacy of the frogs then.
Truly, if you were asking like what the legacy of the frogs is, it is that it led into a really stupid bit on the Comedy Bang Bang podcast.
What's another song in this show that you like? One that's one of the newer songs. Are there any? Because honestly, there really aren't any for me.
I like the original one, the Evoe, the like Hymn to Dionysus.
Yes.
It also makes sense that it was written like directly after Company because parts of it sound exactly like Company.
Yeah, it's... because that's the song that's essentially the orgy, right? Where the Dionysians are saying like, we hail Dionysus and we drink the wine and all this stuff. And it's very you know what it reminds you of? It reminds you a lot of like the Bobby, the disembodied voices in Company, the Bobby that's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, there's very, parts in the middle that become like the dance-ish section that sound like my good and crazy people, my friends. It like sounds exactly like Company, but I like it.
It's very siren-like. I enjoy it.
What do I like of the new stuff? I said I like Dress Big. I took notes when I was watching it.
You texted me about this, Dress Big.
Yeah, Dress Big has a bit from The Birdcage directly lifted.
What's the bit? So Dress Big...
He's teaching him how to walk, and he's basically being, like, too fossy, too this. And it's like, oh, this is, like, straight up, just, like, right from I Pierce the Toast.
Yeah.
This is exactly it.
Dress Big is a song when Dionysus goes to his half-brother, Heracles, and he's like, you've been to Hades and came back, like, any advice? And basically he's like, be manly, dress big. So he sings a song called Dress Big, and the point of the song is by the end of it, he's like, oh, I'll give you one of my lion furs, and you'll pretend to be me.
You don't walk, you stride, you don't amble, you don't sidle, you're a mind then, you're an idol.
Well, you don't expect me to carry that gigantic club around, do you?
What kind of a god are you?
The kind with lower back problems.
And don't say lower back problems, say I have a spine of steel! yell. You don't talk, you growl. You don't mutter things, you roar 'em. It's a matters of decorum, ignore 'em. You gotta act big and loud and rough.
But the entire song is him being like, try this on, try that on. Act like this, walk like this.
Walk like this, don't do this with your hands.
Yeah.
I mean, look, is it a great song? Put it this way. When I was writing in my notes what I thought I sounded like, I said I thought that it sounded like No Life from Sunday in the Park with George, which is nobody's favorite song from Sunday. So for me to be like, I liked this song. You know what it reminded me of? No Life. It's crazy. But I did like it. I think it's funny. I like the parts of the show that feel the most like forum, like stupid.
Sure. You know what I mean? It's my issue with this song and a lot of the new stuff is that I feel like there's no real structure to it. There's no beginning, middle, and end. It just sort of feels like it continues and continues and then just ends.
Yeah, that song goes on for a really long time. And yeah. Ditto to I Love to Travel, which I actually, again, don't think is a bad song at all. It just like is too long. It's just a very long song.
Well, and I Love to Travel originally was just the chorus when it was written in the 70s. It was the like, lop, lop, travel, all that.
And that part's good too, but I still like the like, I love to travel. Yeah. I still like it. I just want it to be shorter.
Yeah, well, it's also a dichotomy of those two where it's like the chorus is sounding like a different genre than the bulk of the song itself, which I maybe that's supposed to be the joke, similar to the opening of like this heavy Greek music singing and then ba-da-ba-da-ba.
As a concept, I don't dislike that. That like the Greek chorus is the one that's going to like keep the show on track, tonally speaking. Like, don't forget this is a serious show, and that like our protagonists skew contemporary and bawdy and like can't like, oh, we can't contain them. They're so wild. Like, I don't mind that. I think conceptually that still could kind of work. And I also think that like there's a lot of funny dialogue, but for the two of them, they both got good jokes and they both deliver them really well. So that's why, like, when you're seeing the show, I can't imagine being like, I'm having an actively bad time. I just don't think it's a memorable show.
I love to travel, don't you? I love a change of pace, I love a change of space, I love to see a place that's absolutely new.
Sweat.
I love to travel, bump, don't you?
Limp,
of course you
wet,
do.
Puff, puff, drip, drip,
doodle. I love to travel, it's true. I love a change of venue.
Dress big.
You're just coming for me for being LA, saying that I like this song.
No, like what you like, girl.
I like it better than Ariadne.
Okay, great, fantastic. I'm so glad you brought this up, because in every single review that I read, and then on top of this, the website that I've had to write cast album reviews for, I was reading the reviews for the Frogs albums, and it was my editor who reviewed them, and he really likes it. Especially he likes the new one, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And he talks about Ariadne, and a couple of other reviewers talked about Ariadne, and they're like, this should be, you know, a laugh in the face of to anyone who says that Sondheim can't write an emotional song, can't write a beautiful love song. And I'm like, I was listening to it.
It's not very good.
It's not. What it reminded me of, just in terms of execution. So basically, I agree with you in terms of concept for I Love to Travel. Of like, also, I love how we were talking about I Love to Travel, and then my brain went back to Dress Big, because in my mind, they're all the same song.
They're all No Life from Sunday in the Park with
They're
George.
All No Life. Well, it's all these songs where I'm like, in concept, I'm totally on board. The execution doesn't do it for me. And it's something that I've started to find with Sondheim in the last part of his writing career. And you see it a lot with Roadshow. These songs that kind of feel like nothing and almost feels like he's leaning into the narrative that he's not writing melodic songs in his career.
Because
people are like, oh, he doesn't write hummable stuff. I'm like, you tell me that you can't hum Another 100 people, or like you.
Yeah,
can't.
Or even like Move On, or like.
Yeah, like.
Crazy. Being Alive.
Like beautiful songs, like amazing, amazing melodies. And there are some things in those shows where I'm like, yeah, okay, I get that, but that's not supposed to be the hummable song. Like, you're not supposed to walk out of the theater of Night Music and go like, Perpetual Anticipation, that's a bop.
Exactly. Although, can I say, it is a bop.
I love it. No,
it's
I love
like a,
it very
a
much.
A minute and 11 seconds, and you're like, okay, give me it.
But it does exactly what it's supposed to do. It's, it's a scenic transition moment. It's good. But like, you know, also moments of passion. I'm like, yeah, no, I absolutely understand. Like, I read is not you walking out of the theater being like, that's going to be a radio hit.
Totally.
But it still like kind of works, but I get it. It's like, he's starting to lean into that era. And then with Roadshow and with the Frogs, it's like, I don't know. It's almost as if like the lyrics are still there. He still has the well for the lyrics, but the music, it's like, it's almost as if he has the nugget in his brain and he just can't expand upon it. And that's what I see with something like Ariadne. So what I wrote in my notes, and it's such a, I realize it's sort of an asshole thing to say, because it's, I'm now coming for two things with this note. But I said, it reminds me of the score to Amelie in the sense that I don't think the song itself is any good, but the accompaniment is lovely.
That, okay, I agree with that. I'm not going to come for Amelie as hard as you, but I think that that is a fair criticism of both songs / scores.
So, and I had to write a review for the cast album for Amelie after having seen it on Broadway, and I was like, okay, well, that happened. And what I realized with Amelie is like a song will start and I'm like, oh, maybe this song's better than I remembered it. Cause like the intro is always so wonderful.
Yes.
And then the song begins and I'm like, it's not actively awful, but I'm like, I'm kind of forgetting about it the moment it's happening. And then especially once it's over, they kind of just like float and then wither away.
So I gave her a crown on the day we were wed. If you look like a goddess, you'll feel like a goddess, I said, Ariadne. And the years filled with joy.
I kind of wish everything had like musical improv rules. Like, I know that's insane because, like, obviously, like, musicals that you make up aren't as good as musicals that you write, duh. But, like, I kind of wish there were some rules that were just like, hey, we have 40 minutes for the whole thing. So, like, yeah, we got to say what we mean to say real quick up top, and then we got to move on.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of like, I don't know. I've talked about it before. Having boundaries really helps you creatively speaking when it's like you have to make this happen in this song and like only this song, you can't do something else, and like this has to be what it's about, and you have all these like other limitations. It helps your creative juices of like of how you go about writing something when it's just carte blanche, blank check. It's like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with that? And Rachel Bloom talks all about all the time with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She was like, the moment we were on the CW, it ended up being such a blessing because we had to figure out a way to get all the jokes we were going to do on Showtime past the censors on CW. And it made them much more creative. But yeah, like with the Frogs, because Nathan Lane basically was like, we need these songs. We're like, do what you want. Like, you're Sondheim. I'm Nathan Lane. This is Lincoln Center. They're going to let us do whatever we want. It's like, you can sort of hear, it's like, oh no, I guess blah, blah, blah. There you go. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, good enough.
And the truth is, it's good enough. It like completely and totally is exactly good enough.
Yeah.
It's like a score with some bops. It's not too long. There are some really good jokes. There are some serious moments that don't land. You leave completely and totally unoffended that you spent your time there. The end.
What makes me angry is the song for the boatman, whose name is, I believe, Karen.
Yes, Karen. Charon.
And, oh God, if that show came out today, the jokes wouldn't they would make about
it. And then we'd have so many more jokes. But honestly, they'd be better.
I don't know.
Okay, can I say, though, I actually laughed, like, really, really actually laughed at Get Your Kicks on the River Styx.
I love that. My personal favorite, so Karen has an intro song, which is then repeated in Act 2, called All Aboard, and it is the longest.
It's so slowest, long, it's so
and
long.
It's so slow. And what I don't so know long. If, like, I don't.
And also, there's not a joke in it being long. Like, it's not like a, oh, is he done talking? Oh, he's still talking. Like, there's just no joke. The boat just slowly approaches and he sings the entirety of the song.
So slowly. And I don't know if, like, the song was written and then Stroman was like, how do I make this work for this long ass song? Oh, I'll have the boat descend from the flies over 3 minutes. Or if Stroman was like, I really want a song for the boatman, and I think what I want to do is have the boat come down from the flies, but it's going to take a minute. Can you write a song?
Yeah, that's 3.5 minutes. Exactly.
Exactly. And Sondheim's like, yeah, sure, fine, whatever. It's just one of those songs where, like, it's so unnecessary. It's so long.
It's so long.
The other line I like where he says, basically it's him being like, get on the boat as long as you're dead. Like, that's the gist of the song, is this is a boat for dead people. So get on board if you're dead. And one of the lines he has is, no delay as long as you're DOA. I think that's fun.
There are some, I mean, like, we're talking about Sondheim here. So it's like, are we ever going to say that anything that's in this show is like pinnacle of his career? Probably not. But like, that doesn't mean it's like a complete and total bust. I'm going to see if I wrote down any other lines that I liked. Because I did write down, get your kicks on the river stick.
The reason why I feel like the show is kind of a bust is just because it is, for me, it is sort of just such a nothing show. It's not offensively bad, but there's very little about it that's so good. And because I like the opening song so much, everything that sort of follows suit is such a disappointment to me.
Yeah, I didn't write down any more lyrics, but I did write down one thing in Act Two, which is when they've changed identities a couple times.
Yeah.
And so now Xanthius is dressed as Heracles, aka Dionysus is Heracles, and Dionysus the god is dressed as the slave Xanthius. And Heracles is getting all this attention because he's like a hero. So like Xanthius the slave, Roger Bart, is like being like, oh, look at all these people like paying attention to me. And Hades himself is like, you know, laying on all this attention, all this praise and stuff. And Dionysus gets kind of jealous and is like, and I am Xanthius. And the guy who plays Hades goes, that means nothing to me. I really enjoyed that.
I also love Pluto's the one who is like, that's clear, neither of these are clearly Heracles. But the way he says like how Dionysus can't be Heracles, like Heracles is this big, strong, masculine thing. That's so clearly not you. And Nathan Lane as Dionysus is basically just like, well, fuck my drag.
Fuck my drag, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all silly, but it's like, I don't mind silly at all.
I don't mind silly either, but it is one of those things where like, it just kind of needs to get tightened up a bit. Cause the joke with them constantly switching places as Heracles. So again, like Heracles, Dionysus, his half brother had been to Hades before and, you know, did what he needed to do. And like one of the big things he did was he killed the three-headed dog.
Yes, Cerberus, the three-headed dog. He killed Michael Cerberus.
He killed Michael Cerberus.
It was serious.
James Woods killed Michael Cerberus.
Serious.
So, guys, it was super serious. But so, when they're down there and Dionysus is in the Heracles getup, basically what happens is every time that Dionysus is in the getup, someone who's pissed off at Heracles is like, fuck you for, you have a lot of gall coming back down here after what you did and all your stuff. And Dionysus is like, okay, we're switching robes. Like, I'm giving you the Heracles stuff. And then anytime Xanthius puts it on, some like beautiful woman comes out. She's like, oh my God, Heracles, there you are. Come join me. We're going to fuck.
I'm naked right now. I got seven naked girls with huge heaving titties and they're all waiting for you.
we're all good to go, Heracles. Come join us. And Dionysus is like, okay, so we're switching. Right. And then as soon as they put it back on, someone else comes out and they're like, Heracles, you got a lot of gall.
Fuck you up. Actually, one of the true scene stealers of the show is this woman who plays some Amazon whose name evades me, but the actress's name is Pia Glenn, and she's so funny. She comes on, she just like does a monologue, she exits like up a ladder.
Yeah.
It's wild. It's like a great example of somebody who was like, yeah, I got this, four lines, oh don't worry.
Mm-mm.
This Honey will be a deal for me, baby.
I'm going to get exit applause.
And she does get exit applause. Yes, she does. And she's great. She was a staff writer on Jordan Klepper's show The Opposition for its one season that it ran.
And you can tell because she makes some bold writer choices.
Yeah, she rewrote the whole show in that moment. It's great though. But yeah, I like, if the show was more Forum, it would be a better show.
Yes.
Which is obviously a very silly thing to say because like Forum already exists, so you can't just like do Forum again. So like I understand that as a piece of criticism, that means essentially nothing. But like those moments where they're trading back and forth and how it pays out and I shouldn't have done this, but it's too late now because I've already set in motion that this person's going to arrive here at 3 and I need the gold coin and this person, that like that's the fun shit.
Yeah. Well, so Forum, the first act of Forum is all basically just set up. And it's actually the opposite problem of the frogs, whereas Forum, the first act is literally an hour and a half.
And the second act is about 40 minutes.
Yeah, so maybe even less. I remember when Patrick Sulkin came out to talk about Forum, and I was, because I never actually watched a full production of it before, and I was watching it for research, and I texted him, I was like, it's very brave that like 75% of the show is just act one.
Yeah, also when I was talking to Patrick about him having recorded the Forum episode with you, I remembered that when I did Forum at the Westin Playhouse, I was one of the Gemini and I was, wait for it, bad. so bad. But, you know, I did other shows that season, so I like had to get shoved into that one somewhere. The guy who played Erroneous? Is he the like super old one?
Yeah, he's the one whose house he's like never at. And the name is because he's Erroneous.
And he keeps being like five more times, he's supposed to go around this things like seven times.
Yeah.
He was played by this old man, like a man definitely in his 70s, if not his 80s. And every single time before we started act two, because it was so short, he'd go, I could drop acid and it wouldn't even kick in until the show was done. So, and he said it so much that I was like, do you want to drop acid? Like, Are you telling me you're going to do it? Because if you're going to do it, just do it. Like, I support you. I think if it kicks in the last number, that'll be funny. You should go for it. Like, he's like, the high wouldn't even start until the show came down if I took acid at intermission. I'd like, you've told me this.
Allie,
I love it. I think he should have done it.
Allie, I think he just forgot that he told you and forgot that it was you.
I think he wanted to say it. I think he was excited about the prospect of doing acid with the entire cast of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
I think he was hoping that he would say it enough times and eventually you would be like, well, guess what?
Yeah, guess what I brought today?
Mm-hmm. And we're going to do it.
And we're all going to take a tab. And it won't even kick in until act two is over.
But to go back to Forum and Frogs for a second, you brought it up and it's very true. Like Forum is a show where like it all is set up so that way when all the shit hits the fan, like we've put in all the work, we know all the things that are being done and who's who and what needs to be accomplished. So we see all the obstacles and we have fun watching it. And the setup is still very fun. It's like not, it doesn't drag out. Like there are enough plot points that are coming in act one that the hour and a half doesn't feel like an hour and a half. Like a lot of stuff's going down. Frogs is the opposite, where it's like, here's our setup, it's 40 minutes, so like, because there's not a lot to be set up, it's just we got this guy and this thing and this thing, and then act two is so long and there's no real payout for any of it. There's some mix-ups that happen, but like within like after 5 minutes of mistaken identities, Pluto comes in and he's like, you're not Heracles. And it's like,
exactly.
Okay, that plot point's over.
And there's also no like, what's going to happen if they don't get Shaw to come back to Earth?
Yeah.
There's no like, the Earth is going to blow up.
Well,
and,
they
and
even have,
and there's also
this makes me really mad. Sorry to interrupt you, but I have thoughts to say. Because I bring it up all the time, Paddington 2 is such a wonderful
Paddington 2 is a perfect movie.
It's a perfect movie, perfect screenplay, where they have all these things that are set up and they all come into play in the end. They set up at the beginning of Act 2, once they show up at Hades, here's the pamphlet of like, oh, you have to leave before 24 hours is up, otherwise all hell breaks loose. And they don't do anything about it.
They don't do anything. They don't even talk. They're not even like, quick, 10 minutes. Like, and nothing happens.
Time's running out. Like, all these things. Because
that's why every show should be a musical improv show.
Absolutely. Because, like, they never reach the time frame. They never go over the time frame. So hell never does break loose. They're never like, I don't have a lot of time to explain myself. You just got to come up and do it.
There's
and, like,
also like a kind of a thing that's set up in act one that like Dionysus is like, after all, I'm a god. And Xanthias keeps being like, you're a half god.
Yeah.
And there's like kind of an implication that he doesn't get as much respect as his like full god cousins who live on Mount Olympus. But there's not like an adjacent like, kind of like how Free is like such a good I Want song for Forum, which is a show without I Wants.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it sets up stakes. So you're like, this is my protagonist. He wants to be free. This song's a banger and it slaps. And I, as the audience member after watching the song, want him to accomplish what he accomplished because I want him to be free. Like there's no like Dionysus, like once I get Bernard Shaw back, I'll get to be partying with the gods.
I'll be respected. People will.
Yeah, there's no like, want in it besides this like grand sort of like, well, humanity needs it. But it's like, we all know for writing, you can't ever make somebody's justification for doing something like it'll be better for humanity. It's like, it always has to be a personal want. And there's like very little personal want in the show, except for like, you kind of think maybe something about his ex-lover or Ariadne who died, who was immortal, and he does run into her in act two, but she just kind of like whispers in his ear and he's like, thank you, sweetheart.
Yeah, you know, he gets closure with her, but like there's no stakes.
You don't feel anything
because you don't find out about her until towards the end of act one when they're in the boat and he sings the song, and then she's never brought up again until halfway through act two, further than halfway through act two. Like they
and
don't
there's
bring
not
her
even
again.
Like a moment of him being like, what if I wanted to stay and be with Ariadne, and then Xanthias being like, you can't stay, all hell will like break loose, haven't you heard, we're mortals in Hades.
Actually,
like, none of that comes together.
Xanthias fucking stays in Hades at the end of the show, and no one's like, you can't do that.
Wait, are you serious?
Yes.
I don't even remember that.
Nathan Lane tells Roger Bart, he's like, time to go. And Roger Bart's like, actually, I just got my brain
railed by seven ladies with huge tits.
Yeah, it's like, I just got fucked by seven different women who want more. Down
I don't
here,
remember
I'm not,
him staying.
Down
I totally
here, I'm not
believe
a slave.
You.
Yeah, they say goodbye at the dock, and Nathan Lane goes back up to Earth with Shakespeare. And then on top of that, what's interesting is like Shaw. I don't think it would be an interesting obstacle if like he gets to Shaw and Shaw's like, I don't want to go back up to Earth.
Yeah, I don't like it there.
Yeah, he's basically like, oh, sure, fine, whatever. And then like Shakespeare comes in and Shakespeare is the one who's like, I don't want to go back up to Earth. And Dionysus is like, great, I don't want to take you anyway.
Yeah, I know. And then he does. And after all, it's all very.
Yeah, it's it's very episodic, but the episodicness doesn't have any kind, as you said, it has no stakes, doesn't build to anything. It's just there. And on top of that, with the Sondheim stuff, so Pluto's song Hades, which is meant to be very like jazz lounge singer, like, oh, it's all wonderful down here, because like you think it's hell on, you think that it's you know, all torture, but actually it's Bobby Darin at the Copa, and he sings this song that's supposed to be like that, and you can kind of hear the seed of that in the music, but Sondheim being Sondheim at this point of his career, he can't physically bring himself to make it a fully thought out melody. It's like the melody begins and you're like, oh, here's something that's really nice, and then he does something weird with it and you're like, but that just doesn't fit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it has a weird bridge and a really catchy chorus, so to speak.
Yeah, but even the chorus I think is only like 60% catchy, because every like third line there's something that's thrown in there. You're like, well, now it just seems like you added nine more words to the phrase when they don't fit in there, and you added music to make it fit.
It has that Sondheim thing, which can be amazing, which is like line, line, line of a very, very, very different length line.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, da-da-da-da, live in Hades, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then like the third line will be like, da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, oh, that's that Sondheim syncopation, and it's so witty. Mm-hmm. And like, it does work in other songs. Like, I'm not being like, haha, there's Sondheim doing his dumb shit that he always do. It's like, obviously really good, but it's just like not to the best of its ability in that song.
Sure.
Although I do think the song is like the highlight of Act Two.
It's very much the highlight of Act Two, which, well, Act Two weirdly is also kind of ballad heavy.
Yeah.
This and Shaw are, as far as I'm aware, are like really the only up-tempos, because even like the hymnus to Dionysus that the ensemble sings, like the big orgy thing, which has this beautiful melody to it and like a good dance break, it's long, and like it's also very ethereal. It's not like a bop, you know.
Yeah, there is a section in the middle that kind of sounds TikTok-y from Company. Mm-hmm. And that kind of is a bop, but the rest of it is sort of like, ooh,
well, TikTok is just Someone Is Waiting.
Okay.
Da, 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 da.
No, you're not wrong.
I only know this because I literally have listened
just
to some
episode.
I literally just listened to So Much Company a week or two ago, so it's all still in my brain, which is why it's interesting that like, as I've done this out of order, it's been very fascinating to listen to all the music, and especially because in true Sondheim fashion, I actually recorded this series in a great way when you think about it, because of his last three quote-unquote new musicals. The Frogs is technically the second to last new Sondheim score, but half of it was written 30 years prior, like before Pacific Overtures, before Sweeney. And same as like how Saturday Night came out in 2000, but it was actually written before West Side Story. But in a weird way, Saturday Night, The Frogs, and then Roadshow all are kind of similar in a way, where it's like these songs that are like almost songs, but they're not quite songs, with lyrics that are awesome, like these really well thought out and genuinely witty lyrics. And then music where it's like, I kind of like it. There's a moment here that I really enjoy, but then it doesn't connect to this way. Whereas something like Sweeney or Night Music or even Passion, if there may not always be a moment that I like, but it connects to something else in a way that I'm like, oh, I see what you did there. And that's awesome.
Completely. When I talk to people who aren't like theater nerds the way that we are, maybe even theater enthusiasts, but not like straight up just like shoot us in the head nerds, like, mm-hmm. like shut up, stop talking nerds.
Yeah.
When I try to explain why I don't think many contemporary musicals are actually musicals, they're just like plays with music. Mm-hmm. They're like, explain to me what you mean. Because I'm like, okay, doesn't mean that they're not good songs. Like, I'm not saying that like, this is a piece of shit garbage, nobody should ever see this again. I'm just saying it's not a musical, because a musical has motif, It has foreshadowing in the music. The music is there to serve the text. The text is there to serve the music. There are lyrical echoes and musical echoes, and that's why it's a musical and not a series of songs, because like you write a score to like, a score is a complete score. And like Sweeney Todd is like a perfect example of that, because there's like, there's foreshadowing in the underscoring that shows you that the baker's wife, kill me, that the beggar woman is, you know, Lucy is his wife.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the show, and like you don't know it when you're watching it the first time through, which is genius, but it's all there. Like that is like, that is a true blue musical, and there's like lyrical foreshadowing and things that change, and there's the three different Joannas that span. This isn't the Sondheim episode. This isn't the episode I'm hired to talk about. Hired because you're paying me, by the way.
Paying you in compliments.
But basically, like the frogs is a Sondheim musical that is not truly a musical. It is like a Sondheim show with a pretty good score and a funny book, but it does not have the benchmarks of like the capital S, capital M Sondheim musical.
Yeah, and before anyone comes for me, like Sondheim himself has no real opinions about the show. He's like, I did it in the 70s. It was for a lark. And, you know, I look back and I'm like, it was pretty decent for what it was supposed to be. And then I was asked to like make it more of a musical later on. And my heart wasn't really in it. And he even says like, he sometimes only as good as his collaborators, right? Like the people he works with and the stories that interest him. And The Frogs was something that he essentially was hired to do. He did it as a favor. In the 70s. And then he did it again in 2004 for Nathan Lane, but he doesn't even discuss Nathan Lane as a collaborator. He's like, I did it for a star, which tells you sort of how he felt about the writing process for the new version. He was like,
for sure.
He was like, these are all star demands, rather than like a book writer being like, hey, we need a song for this character for X, Y, and Z.
Correct. And also like, I don't think it's offensive necessarily to say that like, Nathan Lane is a star performer who might be a great joke writer and like is not the best book writer in the entire universe. Like, I don't think that's like
totally
an unfair criticism.
No, but it tells you sort of where Sondheim's mind was at when this collaboration, quote unquote, was happening, where like he didn't think of it as, oh, Nathan, this performer who I've worked with, who I like and blah, 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 and is very smart. And I don't know, maybe he could come up with a good book. George Firth was an actor before he started writing scripts. So he views it much more as like, oh, this was a star demand for a star show. And I think Nathan Lane truly wanted to make this a fully fleshed out musical. And that just wasn't in the cards. There was one last thing I was gonna say. And then I was so rudely interrupted by you with your thoughts.
With my thoughts about musicals.
Oh, not The Frogs, but I mentioned it on the Sweeney Todd episode. Do you remember when I ran to you the day that I realized that the music that the beggar woman sings when she has her split personalities is the same music as the like dance music in Poor Thing?
Yes.
You remember that day?
Yes, I like 100%, because like that is like why the musical is a musical and not like a series of songs with a book that connects it.
I discussed it on the Sweeney Todd episode, which if you haven't listened to it yet, go back and listen to it. I do remember that moment with you because it was at Stage Door, and I was like, I don't know what was going on in my head. I would think I was just sort of thinking it through, and I was going to the da 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 da, and I remember jumping up and running across the dining hall to you, and I was like, Allie, the music in Poor Thing when Lucy goes to the party, that music, that minuet or whatever the fuck it is, that's the Beggar Woman's music when she's having her split personality. And you're like, I know, isn't it awesome? And on top of that, I was like, oh, that's how I should react whenever somebody realizes something that I already know. Never
oh
be
my,
like
so funny.
Never be like, oh, you didn't know that.
You
were like,
I thought you were gonna say that's how I should react when somebody says something that I didn't know, but I want to seem smart. Just be like, yeah, I know, right? How cool. Like
no,
just be like, I completely knew.
When it comes to Broadway stuff, like I'm sure there are things you could tell me. There's not a lot. I know a lot of it. This is what I've spent the majority of my life looking into, not just like listening to shows, but like reading up on how they came to be and all the backstage stories, you know?
Completely. Yeah, you knew so much more about the history of frogs than I did. So I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. Why do we think it's called The Frogs again? Because people are frogs?
Because people are frogs. Because Aristophanes wrote a thing called The Frogs, and that was so he wrote it in stone, quite literally.
Yeah. Literally, when I was watching it, because he talks about Dionysus, he's like, I don't like frogs. It's very Indiana Jones and why did it have to be snakes?
Completely.
He's like, I don't like frogs. But then, and then like they go down the river and there's like a whole frog ballet where the frogs try to capture him, but he's able to get back in the boat. And that's technically speaking why it's called The Frogs. It's I don't know, it's calling The Social Network Rooney Mara, because she has right. that one scene, and like it's a good scene, but
yeah, you're
it's
like
the
she's
one
good
scene.
In that scene. Yeah, no, it's very like they don't even like talk about the frogs again really after, because like I kind of think it would even be thematically better if like somebody like Shaw was like, what's the point of going back to Earth when like it seems nowadays everybody's frogs, you know what yeah. I mean? I don't know, that was really bad, so please don't take that as, like, it's like
frogs,
amazing writing, but like they don't even bring it back to be like frogs are people who resist change and
yeah.
are happy with the status quo, and they kind of like fuck you to yeah, you try
they
not
mention
have your
they
ideas.
Mention it for a second, but it's again it's very tossed off, where he's like, you know, people it's like, because you know the frogs are just so complacent, and I'm like, you haven't explicitly stated who the frogs are. Like, it took me rewatching that scene 3 times to go, oh, you mean like the people,
right?
You mean the people, like, are complacent.
Exactly. And it's like, and again, like they don't make a statement on like, are the frogs everybody? Like, yeah. is the point like, hey, even you're a frog. Like, you might think that you are, your mind is expanded. You are so woke. You're like sitting here in your liberal elite city watching a show at Lincoln Center Theater, the mm-hmm. gayest place in the world. And even you are complacent when it comes to a lot of things. Like, you might not think it of yourself, but you can be a frog too. That's like not even the point. You know what I mean?
Lincoln Center, the real estate equivalent of a pauper.
I mean, when you've like done how many revivals of Anything Goes there, at a certain point you have to just like call it a gay landmark.
When you've gone through the entire Rodgers and Hammerstein canon, and like
you just gotta throw in the towel,
and you become like the housing space for John Guare plays, like, you know exactly who you are
completely.
Yeah, so we'll wrap it up. So The Frogs opens July 22nd of 2004. There's some backstage drama because Roger Bart was not supposed to be Xanthias. It was
yes,
originally
in up to previews it was somebody else.
It was Chris Kattan of SNL
who
fame.
Is not good in it.
He's not good. There is a video of him doing it, and he's not.
And it's not good.
He's not good.
Was he fired or did he quit? Or did he quit with parentheses around it?
He was fired. He was let go. It was originally stated that he was let go because his performance just wasn't working out. Which, when you watch the video, like, yes, he is not good, but it's not like a disastrous performance. You're just you're out of your element. Like, you're doing everything, technically speaking, that's required of you, but like, you're not owning the stage. You're not really enjoying yourself. You're kind of just like, it's still very much, okay, and I have to move here now, because if I move here, then the turntable moves now and my note comes up here. Right. Not someone who's like lived in theater and it's much more second nature. There was then a blind item the next day that basically said, like, he was more interested doing lines in his dressing room than learning his lines on stage.
Ooh, I did not know this drama.
I mean, I'm not confirming nor denying, I was not backstage when it was happening, but that was what the blind item stated.
Uh-huh.
And there was no press statement from the production that was like, that is not true. They just never addressed it.
Yeah, so which is probably like the fairest thing to do, is just be like, la 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 la.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah, not prolong it. But yes, Roger Bart came in literally like the last week or two of previews and had to learn the show in like 3 days, and I think was doing it for maybe 8 performances when critics finally came. So they're like, we're judging your performance after only doing it 8 times.
And that's wild. I mean, he's really good. Like,
he is.
I also am a big fan. I like think he has some of those syncratic things that, like, I'm sure some people find like nails on a chalkboard, but for me they don't. Like, for me, I like the taste of the sirloin after the cake, you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
I think he's really funny, and I think he is like exactly the right person for this role, which is like a nothing role on paper. And he has like a couple little moments that he just makes a meal, which
yeah.
is like, what else can you possibly ask for?
Yeah. Well, he and Nathan Lane make a good team, and they're actually very similar types, because they are very specific comedic actors where I wouldn't necessarily call them chameleons. They bring a lot of themselves to each role, and they make it work because they are talented and very intelligent, but they also have certain like trademark ways of saying a punchline to make it funny.
Yes.
So, like, Nathan Lane likes to use.
I also think they did do The Producers together as Bialystock and Bloom briefly.
Maybe.
I think Nathan Lane stayed in the show for longer, or maybe came back to the show when Roger Bart had been moved from one role to the other.
Yeah. Roger Bart, I know, did Leo Bloom for a while, and Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick came back to do the show. And maybe at one point Roger Bart did it as well.
I weirdly think I have a playbill that has the two of them on the front. And I
that would have been pretty good.
I will look for that for you.
I mean, he's still one of my favorite comedic performances as Carmen Gia. It's one Incredible. Of those things where it's like, it's offensively stereotypical and I laugh the entire time.
Yeah. Also, the line reading of, if your intention was to shoot an arrow through my heart, bullseye is like one of the funniest. It's music. You can hear it in your head. It's perfect. Yeah.
He's got an innate rhythm in his self that knows how to make a punchline work. But like, you know what I mean? Nathan Lane does that really like exasperated whisper thing sometimes to get a punchline. Yes. He goes, I've done it all this way. Like, you know, and then Roger Bart likes to kind of do a talk, shout,
yes,
kind of thing.
But it's good. They work together well.
Yeah. And they to their credit, they use it very intelligently. So even if you know like that's part of their bag of tricks, like you can't ever fault them for using it because they use it at the right time.
Completely. And they still find time to surprise you with it also.
Yes. This production also, while watching it, is very interesting. It's very early 2000s for me. It's very Stroman at this time, where like very bright colors, very clean sets, and very precise choreography that's like very pleasant and professional, but also, I don't know, like it's just, there was a time on Broadway where like a lot of sets were very kind of like bright candy color hued. You know what I mean? Like this is the same season as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And I think Never Gonna Dance was around the same time.
I saw both of those shows. And I also saw, when I saw Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, this is all just stories about me as a 14-year-old in New York City. I saw Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with my cousin, Rebecca. We were by myself for the first time.
Hey, Rebecca.
We were sitting and we were the two off the aisle. So there was one seat on the aisle. And we were like, this person's late. Like, should we move over? It'd be so cool. Oh my God. If when the lights go down, somebody still hasn't moved here, let's move over one. And then as the lights went down, Liza Minnelli walked down the aisle and sat down in the empty seat. And I sat next to Liza Minnelli. The end.
That's a wonderful story. You know, who would have done a good job with the show? Speaking of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, John Lithgow and Norbert Leo Butz.
100%.
They could do a good job with the show.
Yeah, I know you're going to ask me about casts, and I feel like I have like some weird opinions about that.
Yeah, the only real legacy the show has is the opening number is still used a lot in a lot of reviews. In fact, the first time I ever came to know the Frogs, or at least anything regarding the Frogs, was the Carol Burnett putting it together, because Invocation and Instructions to the Audience was used as the opening for putting it together. And then I just did not know anything about the Frogs for years and years and years. And then on top of that, I guess you could say, like, you know, Lysistrata Jones, another musical update of a Aristophanes play done on Broadway. But like, Lysistrata had been done as a Broadway musical in the 50s as well. It was called The Happiest Girl in the World. And I don't think that the Frogs can really be taking any credit for it.
I agree.
But, you know, if you want to just like, so there's something to say.
Yeah.
Listen, we'll say it right here, right now. There wouldn't be any Lysistrata Jones if it wasn't for the Frogs.
That's a bold statement. And I wish we could like stand by that so wholeheartedly.
Mm.
The legacy for me of the Frogs is that I met Nathan Lane as a 14-year-old and I was like really stoked.
The legacy of the Frogs is that Barrett Wilbert Weed made her Broadway debut because of the Frogs.
That's wild.
Because she was a swing in Lysistrata Jones.
So all you 14-year-olds...
All
you
of you Heathers, all of you Heathers fans, all of you Mean Girls fans who just can't live without her Janice and her Veronica, you have the Frogs to thank for that.
You better get down on your hands and knees and say, thank you, Roger Bart.
Oh no, it just turned sexual.
I knew that way.
Okay, so rapid fire questions, Allie, as we wrap this up, because she's got things to do.
Wow.
The Sondheim rhyme, what is your favorite lyric in this show?
Get your kicks on the river Styx.
I love it. Mine is, please don't fart. There's very little air and this is art.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Although I do also really like the hymn to Dionysus, when the Dionysians are like, we drink so we can understand the world. And when you understand the world, you need more wine.
Yeah, that's a
like
good
that.
Line too. Yeah. But also, honestly, I think maybe the best line in the Frogs, because it has like... the one that everybody likes the most is those who look down on actors and who doesn't.
Yeah, that's a great one.
That's probably the best line.
It's wonderful. And it helps knock actors down the peg. The actors
are
like,
we all need it.
We all need it. When we post on Instagram of our buttholes and we're like, today was a very brave day for me and I'm going to talk about my mental health, and then you show your hole, it's like, you get needs to get knocked down a peg. Okay, next up. God, that's good. Where does the show rank for you in the Sondheim canon?
Pretty low. unfortunately. Yeah. But that's okay. I think it's like pretty much tied for me, unfortunately, with Roadshow like at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Next up, I Had a Dream cast. Who would you like to see in a production of this show?
I would like the show to be redone, to be maybe a little less ballad heavy. Mm-hmm. And then I want to see it just done crazy. I want to see like Kathy Griffin as Dionysus. I want to see like a true blue female comedian.
Ah, love it.
I want something weird. Do you know what I mean? Like, I want like Sandra Bernhard. Like, I want something weird.
Alex Borstein.
Yes, yes. That's exactly correct. Like, that's what I want to see. I want them to take a little bit of the self-seriousness out mm-hmm. that I think Nathan Lane wanted to do because he's an actor mm-hmm. with a capital A. So, like, no, I'm not trying to, like, cast shade. I just think that he was like, I want a serious ballad. And they're like, okay, whatever. I want somebody who has no interest in that to take those things out. And I want it to be like Alex Borstein.
Love it. I love it so much. Which brings us to our next question. It's the little things, aka there won't be trumpets, which do you get why I made it this title for this section?
It's the little things, aka there won't be trumpets.
For this, this is how you downsize the Sondheim show?
Oh, yeah. Because it's little things like a small set or like trumpets, yeah. What's his name?
There won't be trumpets in the orchestra because you have to downsize. Right. Yeah.
I like that.
I've had to explain that to every single person. They're like, why is that the title for that section? I'm like, I'm funny and interesting. How would you
like it?
Thank you. How would you downsize this Sondheim show? Wacky answers accepted.
I mean, obviously, I don't think a swimming pool is necessary
mm-mm.
to its understanding.
For a 7-minute scene in the show.
Correct. I feel like there could be somebody who's a good director, who's not me, who could like find a weird setting for this to like modernize it that isn't just like kind of ancient Greece but kind of not. Do you know what I mean? Like I mm-hmm. feel like this could potentially like be set someplace weird, like a John Doyle type thing where it's like it actually takes place like outside like a comedy club. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, or in a comedy club.
Yeah, exactly. It's something like where you're traveling someplace and it's like not quite so literal, like we're like literally on the river Styx. It's like we're going around Manhattan and trying to find some like weird basement community where we're gonna pull like a weird artist out of the
oh interesting.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Like so like, literally like a traveling show.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's like the conceit is that we're actually like like in Manhattan trying to find some like weird artist subculture to find like the next great artist who's going to speak to our cultural standpoint. Mm-hmm. So we're like we go down to the Village and we go to like Baby Wants Candy. Well, it's not Baby Wants Candy, that's insane, that's musical improv. Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, is that what it's called?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about? Neo-futurists?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not as cultured as you are.
Well, I embarrassed myself by saying the name of a musical improv team first. Cool. Essentially that, where it's like trying to find like who the next great artist will be that's going to like save us.
Yeah. Okay. I would cut half of the ballads.
Yeah, or half of the show.
Half the
make
show.
Make it a one act.
Make it a one act cut. I would revert to the 90-minute version and like maybe I to please you, I put in the newer version of I Love to Travel.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I'd put in Hades and I would, you know, do a little twinking. And then I'd also do some like double casting. For some reason in this production, like everyone plays their own role. I'm like, have the actor playing Heracles double as Shakespeare. Have like
yeah, or Hades or any of those things.
Yeah, yeah. Like come on, bitch. Like 8-person cast, let's do it.
I agree.
And also don't make the frogs a 10-minute ballet. It's unnecessary. Doesn't need to be there.
Agreed.
So, Allie, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you.
I hope that this episode was interesting to people. I don't know if it'll be.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I guess if like there's somebody out there who's like a Sondheim purist who just like is like, no one ever talks about the frogs.
Yeah.
People would be interested in that.
Or like, I want to learn about the frogs. What do you have to say about it? Turns out yeah. I don't have a
lot to say.
I don't like it very much.
I mean, I do think it certainly speaks to Sondheim's like credit that like the worst thing you can say about his canon of musical theater is like this show is not great, it's forgettable.
Yeah,
like do you know what I mean? Like no, there's not like he didn't write stinkers. This is not like a offensive show or a badly aged show or like a show where you're like what the fuck were you thinking when you did this. It's just like not great.
No, it's just not great. It is some of the earlier stuff is some of the most fun that he has written in his career, where he's just like, oh, I got to sort of be like a fun little kid. I will say though, if you want a better thought through score where you can hear Sondheim really just like having fun and being childlike, listen to his lyrics to the 1974 Candide.
Yeah.
His lyrics, I think, make up probably like 40% of the score in that one, but like, don't know, it's just really fun. And he like makes jokes about pimples and sex with sheep, which they even make a joke about that, I'm pretty sure, in this version, when he's like, come back to Earth where the sheep are nervous. There's like, men are men and sheep are nervous. I'm like, oh, did he make a joke about men fucking sheep?
I think so.
Very fun. So guys, stay tuned for next week, where we close out the Sondheim canon with his final show, Road Show, formerly Bounce, formerly Wise Guys. And in that episode, you will hear me announce the next artist that is lined up for this series. Ooh. And you also, I know, very exciting. And on top of that, you will hear me go through the entire canon and tell you certainly where each show sits for me personally in the canon, having gone through all of them. At this time, I ask all my guests where the show is for them, but now you're going to hear me rank them all personally speaking.
Cool. Do you think we should call Donna Murphy and say we loved her in Passion and have her laugh at us and then go, oh, you're serious?
I'm going to call Donna Murphy and I'm going to go, I saw you in Love Music.
I saw it.
And I loved you in Passion.
Exactly.
No, she was good in Love Music. That just wasn't a good show. Anywho, thank you so much for listening, guys. If you like the podcast, rate, review, subscribe, share it with your friends. Allie, where can people find you on social media?
You can find me basically anywhere that social media exists under the handle Miss Alice Nutting, MSALICENUTTING. Did I make that right after my summer at Stage for Manor where I did Drood? 100% I did, baby.
Yeah, she still lives in the past, honey. Not I, though.
I truly am, though. I'm like, look at me. I was 17. Look how healthy my voice sounds. And bitch, Allie, it did sound healthy.
She did. I don't ever talk about how I just ruined the game for all Stage Dorians when I did Bat Boy. I don't talk about it at all. And I'm devastated that nobody talks about it. I think because it's erasure. That's why.
You're just scared. They're scared to talk about Bat Boy at Stage or Manor.
Yeah. They're like, oh my God, the 08 Bat Boy. Oh, we don't talk about it.
We don't talk about that. Opinions are too great. People will die.
Literally. You can find me on Instagram if you want to see more of my amazing videos, at Matt Koplik, usual spelling. I'm trying to think of a diva to close this out with the frogs. There aren't really any female performers who are associated with the show.
Which is why in my dream revival, it's going to be all women, baby.
All women. We'd love to see it. I think what I'm going to do, because she technically did do it and we haven't done her yet, and she's not really Broadway, but she's Broadway adjacent, we're going to close out today's diva with Miss Meryl Streep.
Love it. Yes. Hit me with that song they wrote for the Into the Woods movie.
She'll be back. She'll be back. No, I think we're going to do Prom, because that's Meryl at her most open-throated.
1,000,000%.
Yeah. All right. So thank you so much for listening, guys. Check us out for Roadshow. Once again, the final episode, you will hear who the next series is going to be on. And on top of that, my final rankings personally of all the Sondheim shows. Take us away, Meryl. Thank you so much. Bye.
But it's all about me, although I'm rich and famous. Publicity is not my final goal. You need fighting. Could I get softer lighting? Wait, this is not about me.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suffs celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.